Hello and welcome to Season 2 of Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Now, as environmental challenges increase, the issue of food sovereignty, that is, having access to local healthy food, becomes an increasingly higher priority. Let me give you an example. A pound of New Zealand grass-fed beef shipped to Salmon Arm generates 25 times as much greenhouse gas as the same grass-fed beef sold, grown and sold locally. In other words, how you choose your food has an enormous influence on the process that we're all wrestling with right now, which is the climate crisis. In order to address it, we have to include something like the food we consume as part of the mix. So once again, today I'm delighted to welcome back a guest who has been on this program three times already, and every time has presented new and interesting information to you, the listeners. That is Andrea Gunner, local agricultural economist and an operation growing turkeys and chickens organically and all of their byproducts as well, and really a voice for agricultural sanity in this area. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you, Warren. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm trying to think of a new introduction for every time you're on this show, and I've so far not run out of ideas. There's lots of things to be said about the work you've done and the influence you've had on the local agricultural scene. So last time we spoke, it was about the experience of running in a formal political, partisan political campaign. And we talked about the various things that that does to a person's life and also about how food issues came into that process. Today, I think we'll talk more about your perspective on the process is necessary to bring us into more accord with biological and environmental ecological processes when we grow and process and then consume food. Now, your extensive experience in how agriculture and food growing systems are constructed and how they function has led you to have lots of examples in your back pocket about what people are doing to try and make a positive difference, to change the way food is grown and where it's grown, etc. So today, maybe we can talk about a couple of examples, one of which you mentioned to me in a past conversation, was about a farmer near Lillooet who broke away from conventional growing practices and did so against the grain. Some of his colleagues might have thought he'd lost his marbles. But in fact, his processes that he introduced in his ranch have actually turned out to be really constructive and at multiple levels. So, Andrea, why don't you launch into this story? Because it's really a compelling story.
Yeah, so I met Tristan Banwell, who is the rancher that we're talking about, who's on the younger side. He's, I think, late 30s, early 40s. And Tristan and his wife found themselves through, you know, various routes, found themselves on a piece of land outside of Lillooet that was not, you know, sort of what was available rather than, and because they're young and full of enthusiasm, they took it on. The things that we do when we're young, when we don't understand the either the cost in time, energy, or capital of what we're actually undertaking.
So he actually took a leap of faith. He bought land because he wanted land.
Well, he didn't actually buy it. It was available by somebody else who owned it or owns it. And still, to get into agriculture on any kind of land, it is a long-term commitment. It's not something that is done lightly or easily over just a year or two.
For sure.
And so they went in and looking at this, they knew that they wanted to do beef. And looking at this, the land had been managed conventionally for many, many years. and it was not an ideal piece of land by any means. And so they realized that following the pathway that Joel Solomon and other people like that have done, which is the more biodiversity you have above the ground leads to the more biodiversity below the ground. He decided, after farming it the same way his neighbors were farming it for a year or two, that he was going to strike out differently.
Would it be fair to say that Tristan, from what you've said, he was an educated future rancher?
Yes.
How had he educated himself?
He had done a lot of webinars and podcasts, but he also had a degree in, I believe, forest ecology. So he did understand something about natural biological systems.
He knew how to pronounce the word ecology.
Yeah, yes. And perhaps a little bit more. And Aubin, his wife, is from a ranching background. So she knew, you know, the practical things of what you do and how you do them. But Tristan, looking at this, decided that he was not going to harrow. Well, everybody harrows. That's the thing you do. If you want your fields to look neat and tidy and clean, you're going to harrow. And so the first year that he decided not to harrow and not to burn, his neighbors all, like everybody, stopped in to say, "Hey, when are you going to harrow, Tristan? You haven't harrowed yet." And so he heard loud and clear from all the neighboring ranches that really he was past it, not doing the harrowing.
Now, did his wife understand this as well? She had obviously, as somewhat of an inspiration with her practical experience, influenced his decision. But what was her attitude towards not harrowing and all these neighbors who she probably had come around in the past saying, "Oh, well, let's harrow now"?
Because he had done so much reading and listened to so many podcasts that he had rationale that I think he tried to tell the other farmers and they really clearly did not want to listen. So he just went, "Okay, fine. I'm the young guy with no ranching background. You know, I'm going to be the example, and they're all going to heap all kinds of scorn on me, but we'll just see how it goes, because they don't expect anything good to come out of this. So what have I got to lose?"
Absolutely.
So he didn't harrow, and he started rotationally grazing his cattle. So what he does is he calls it mob grazing, where he's got, and his herd is trained now. The lead cow knows what she's doing, and she follows Tristan, and Tristan or one of their workers moves the cows. They give them as much grass as they need to deal with a certain problem, and then they move them and they leave that pasture to regenerate.
Andrea, mob grazing. I have this wonderful picture. It's sort of like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, but instead of leading the children to disaster, Tristan is leading his cows to a better place, a better land. Literally.
Yes. And he's not the only one. There's actually a young female rancher, she's probably in mid-30s, who puts on mob grazing clinics in southern Alberta. And she gets cowboys, ranch owners, people from all over Western Canada that come and take these clinics, where she teaches them how to identify. A lot of ranchers don't know which, you know, especially if you're running 600 or 6,000 cows, you don't know which one necessarily is your lead cow. And so she teaches them how to recognize the lead cows and how to work with those lead cows to manage the whole herd. And you get these old cowboys who've been spent most of their lives on horse walking along learning how to lead cows. And it's just think of that picture in your head.
You know, there's the expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. It looks to me like you can lead a cowboy to water and you can make him have a big drink and carry on. This is a transformational change. This is not just a technical change. This is a change in attitude. It's a change in relationship with your animals. You are sort of the lead cow leading the lead cow.
That is exactly it. And you can teach an old dog new tricks. You're right. An old cowboy new tricks. So Tristan and Aubin have worked not only the cows into the mix, but they're also doing pork, they're doing chickens, they're doing turkeys, and they are selling they can't keep up. They basically are just improving their production because the difference in not only the quality and the flavor, but also the fact that people want to support something that is doing good for the world.
Do Aubin and Tristan have the same relationship with their turkeys and chickens that they do with the cows? In other words, do they do mob grazing with the cows and the chickens, or do they have to transport them?
They do not have to transport them. No, you have to move them up to the field. But other than that, they're being moved from the brooder out to the field, and then they get moved because once the animals know, if you do a good job, and we found this ourselves, once we started feeding fresh greens in the brooder to day-old chicks, they very quickly get a taste for it. So they're curious at first. They're maybe a little bit leery of it, mm-hmm. just because they are risk adverse. And then once they know after they've had it 2 or 3 days that maybe there are bugs in there, maybe like just the green stuff, especially the broadleaves are very interesting. Then when they go outside into a brooder pen, they absolutely know that that's food. And so then when you take them out onto full pasture, they are just delighted to get full pasture every day. And they will actually line up at the fence, like in our case, because we have them fenced in a day range system. They will line up at the fence. When they see us at the fence, they know the fence is going to be moved and they're standing there waiting.
I just have this vision, and I have neighbors with chickens, so I understand a little bit of what you're talking about. But the idea of this symbiotic relationship between human and non-human living beings is it's delightful. It's such a different way of relating to your animal friends and, you know, future source of income. It just seems to be a whole different way of relating to animals.
Well, it's taking it back to the 1930s, before the Second World War, when agriculture was transformed by chemical fertilizer. This is the relationship that farmers before 1940 had all over the world, and still in some parts do have, but not in North America. So yeah, we're heading back to that time when farmers understood the biological connection.
So this mob grazing approach started fairly quickly to produce changes in the landscape. What kind of changes were there?
So the big changes, and we've seen this on our own farm, the big changes are that the patches of noxious weeds decline. The grass stays in a vegetative state for longer, and that's exactly what you want, because that is building root mass. And when it's building root mass, then it's also building soil, which is sequestering carbon.
So the landscape, as the years have gone by, has started to look different and started to show different characteristics, especially below the surface.
Yes. So the difference is that instead of having all that dried grass that you would burn or harrow in the spring, you can extend your grazing season. You can train the cows to paw through the snow, and they will. My daughter was working on a ranch in northern Alberta where they were mob grazing until December 31st.
We
had enough
goodness.
Grass stockpiled under the snow, and the 6,000 cows that she was managing were grazing, like scraping the snow, pawing the snow, and then eating that stockpiled grass, which means that the farmer is not haying. Yes, they still buy hay, but for the most part, the cows are feeding themselves rather than the farmer doing the work.
This, I can see a lot of happy farmers and ranchers showing up because they can sit back and watch the herds manage themselves. Is that accurate?
They still have to manage the herd, but they still have to move the herd.
Right.
And they have to plan. They have to do a lot more work on coordination and planning, but they're not running their tractors every day. Hmm. And so it costs them less money. They still have the labor, but they don't have the machine time.
So it would probably be fair to say that this kind of approach and associated approaches are much more, they involve much more mental activities on the part of the farmer or rancher. There's a lot more thought, a lot more planning, a lot more assessment of what's going on.
Yes, yes.
So Andrea, how long have Tristan and Aubin been working with this new to the community approach to land management and looking after their herds? How long?
I think 7 years. I think they started in 2013, 2014.
And obviously over those 7 years, there has been not only a transformation in their land, but clearly a transformation of the experience of all the farmers and ranchers who have visited their land. That must have had an impact.
Tristan has done, so I first met him when I was on a meat industry small-scale producer panel in Chilliwack, and he was one of the other people on the panel. And so I had a great conversation with him afterwards, and then he's a great extension person, so he is willing to share their experiences. He's a very good speaker. He's very organized. He brings props, so he explains the equipment that they use to do it. And so, yes, he has been at a number of conferences, webinars, all that kind of thing, imparting the knowledge that he has learned in turn from going to conferences and talking to other producers across North America who've been doing this for longer.
And it would appear from just a superficial analysis of this process, he has a bit more time to do it because there's a certain amount of autonomy involved in the herd function once it's sort of into its new site on his land and that kind of thing. You can sit back and do some thinking.
You can sit back and do some thinking. And also as a livestock producer, you've got a little bit more time in the winter time to plan and look forward and educate yourself. And so there are a number of livestock producers that are realizing that there are a bunch of podcasts, there are a bunch of webinars. One of the outcomes out of COVID is that so many of the conferences that would have been held in person have been held virtually, and so they're accessible to people across multiple time zones. I've been at conferences with people from China and Europe, and we're all in, you know, some other time zone. And it's really, really the technology that COVID has pushed to the forefront has been very advantageous.
I would remind listeners, by the way, that we're using that very technology today with a Zoom access to Andrea, who's sitting in her office at home, and we're sitting here in the studio and having a wonderful conversation about some wonderful, thoughtful, thought-provoking things. Has, along the way, any attempt been made to analyze the changes in the soil, in the root structures of the vegetation that's growing on the soil? By Tristan and Aubin, have they engaged in that kind of process?
I don't know whether they have. I certainly know other producers that are doing that, but I didn't think to ask Tristan that question when I was last talking to him. I know on our own farm we are analyzing that. We participated in a UVic study this year, and so I'm waiting for the results from that. And there were a number of producers throughout the Lower Mainland, Vancouver Island, and a few in the southern interior and in the Cariboo who participated in that as well. And so what the UVic study is doing, it's actually through the Ecogastronomy Lab at UVic, which I didn't know existed until last winter.
Ecogastronomy?
Ecogastronomy. Looking at the link between what's going on below the ground and what's going into our food.
So I love that word. We need a few new words, don't we?
I'm looking forward to seeing the results of the test plots that were done all over BC this summer.
What have Tristan and Aubin's neighbors started to say, or what are they saying now? Because they're seeing it's working.
Yes, there has been enough time go past that the neighbors no longer think they're nuts. The neighbors have definitely come to the realization that this is working and that they need to be using some of these Some of these practices themselves, yeah, there's definitely been a change in their neighborhood.
So has Tristan told you about some of those experiences he's had with these previous skeptical neighbors who thought nothing would work, and now they're sort of, well, maybe something's going on here that I can pay attention to or whatever, that kind of thing?
Well, I'll tell you a story from something that I did on a ranch in Greenwood a couple of years ago, where at the end of 2 days of soil biology workshop, it wasn't a workshop. It was soil biology 101 sort of 2 day course with field. The retired dairy farmer who was sitting next to me, who was probably in his late 70s, stood up at the end of the second day and said, "Do you remember in the early 80s when all the hippies were doing this stuff with kelp and seaweed and all that hippy dippy thinking?" And I said, "Yep, I remember that." He said, "Sure wish I'd listened."
And then did he say, "I'm going to go off and start doing some of this stuff"?
Well, he was retired, so I'm not actually sure. He was doing it because it was an opportunity in his neighborhood that he found out about through the Kootenai Business Advisors, Kootenai Agriculture Business Advisors group. And he was retired. He wasn't managing his farm, but I'm pretty sure that he was going to go home and tell all his neighbors what he'd learned, because he was a convert at the end of it.
The repentant farmer reminds me of Alcoholics Anonymous roundups, where they have speakers who come along and say, "I've done all these things and now I'm not doing it anymore and life is so much better." Maybe he'll be a good emissary for change, because he can say, "I kind of missed the boat, but don't you miss the boat."
Right.
There's some big things necessary. So this has been a success, and you're seeing movement now across time zones, but certainly across disciplines and in directions that are changing basic farming practices in a number of ways.
The BC government has gotten on side with this. They have launched just recently, they've launched a regenerative agriculture complement. I'm not sure that it's actually a branch, but a number of agrologists through the Ministry of Agriculture that are paying attention to it. They just did their first conference at the end of September with a number of speakers. They're a little bit late to it, quite frankly, because the industry has been moving in this direction, and there are a number of industry associations that have already been moving in this direction. While I congratulate the Ministry of Agriculture for getting on board, I decry the fact that they are not adding any resources to the organic industry that has been doing this for 40 years, over 40 years. And in fact, the federal government has cut some of the funding to organics, which is a standard across the organic industry in other countries. So that's problematic. But they are getting on board with supporting it, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, this is a pattern that's been repeated in multiple settings and in multiple sectors, that governments tend to be a little, they receive input from all sorts of people, and they don't always have the discernment to be able to distinguish what is a genuine new trend and what isn't, and so they kind of hesitate. And then when the trend is strong, they will come on board. There's another example of a situation that we talked about briefly in the South Peace, involving a Hutterite colony that also branched into, in a different way, branched into a similar kind of practice. Maybe we could talk about that for a bit now.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, because all the Hutterite colonies, for anybody who has had any dealings with them, they are very smart business people, and they work collaboratively, not only within their colonies, but across sister colonies as well. So they maintain those links. In this particular colony, which I've visited, I'm really impressed with it. They are farming on, I think, something like 8 or 10 sections. So that's about somewhere around 6,000 acres. It's not a small operation. And they have beef, they have pork, they have their own processing facility, they have chickens, they have turkeys, and they have all the field crops. And they market a wide range. I've been in restaurants in Edmonton, I've been in restaurants in Abbotsford that are buying product from that South Peace colony. Mm. So it's an impressive operation.
It's a complete operation from top to bottom, essentially.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Very much a value chain operation. So they control the distribution, they control everything. And in 2016, the farm manager decided that because of what they're reading in the mainstream media, that there is a trend where people are caring about the nutrition of their food. They are successful, they're an economically viable colony, but they just wondered with this trend in the media that people care more about their food, how it's produced, what is in it, that maybe they should make sure that they were doing everything possible. So they brought in a soils microbiologist from New Zealand who does work in North America and showed her their soil samples and took her out on a field tour.
For our listeners, can we name this New Zealand soil specialist?
Nicole Masters. And so she went out to the fields with the farm manager and took her refractometer and did some leaf tissue samples and looked at the crops and looked at the soil samples, which she'd already and sort of compared the two and drove around. And then at the end of a couple of hours of driving around, looking at all these fields, she said, "You're low in manganese here, you're low in boron there, you don't have enough calcium here, you've got too much nitrogen everywhere, and this is what I think you should do."
Just let's pause for a moment and explain what a refractometer is and what it does so that listeners understand that concept.
Okay, shall I grab one or shall I just tell you what it is? It's a little tube that's about maybe 6 inches long and about maybe an inch in diameter. And at one end, it's got a glass as if it's a microscopic plate that you would put under a microscope, a glass plate. And what you do is you put your leaf sample, you crush up your leaf sample, and you put it between the two glass plates, and it shines a light through it, and it gives you a reading. And what it's doing is it's reading sugars and nutrients in it, and it's telling you. It varies depending on the times of day, because of course plants cycle with the various times of day, but you can get an early indication of what's going on, and it's a useful thing to use, especially if you use it along with bricks, so that you're actually looking at the plant sugars too.
Now for listeners who can't see the screen that I'm seeing, we're just looking now. Andrea's holding up a refractometer. It's a device that you wouldn't recognize immediately as something that you would use in your household. You don't stir your soup with it, but it has a plate at one end. It has two plates. You put the sample between the two plates, then you flip one of them down to capture that sample of leaf. And then from the other end, you look through, and presumably you see various wavelengths of light of some sort, or do you just see a statement that says this is missing, that's present, that kind of thing?
No, what you see is you see the light and you see lines on the light, and you can adjust it. So it's like a it really is like looking through a microscope as a field thing. And then there are lines, so you can tell the levels, and we mark them down. We take a little recording book out with us and take the field samples and note the time of day and what we're looking at, and then just keep a record of it so that we know what's going on with our, what's happening on our fields.
So how widely used are refractometers? Are they used by farmers themselves? Are they used by consultants? Are they used by government people? Who uses them?
I would say all of those, and there are more and more farmers using them than there were certainly 5 years ago.
And this at one level is revolutionizing farming because people now know precisely what minerals in particular. Is it minerals that it measures mostly?
It actually measures the biological activity.
Okay.
So that you're seeing, and it's variable because of the different plants and the different times of day, but it's a way of checking on what's going on and just getting to know your crops.
I see. So a person who uses it has to know a little bit about the data that it generates. You have to know
That's
what
right.
it means, and you have to know That's about right. those these variations and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's these devices are widely used, and are they are they having an impact? I mean, they must be having an impact. This Hutterite colony, this was a key to developing their new program.
Well, the bigger thing was Nicole's expertise.
Yes.
And so what she told the farm manager, he looked at her and said, and he's a big taciturn guy. She showed pictures of him and he doesn't smile. Anyway, he looked at her and said, we need to have a team meeting. So they drove back to the colony and everybody was assembled. He'd phoned or texted everybody on the way. And so she walked into the room with the head guy, and there are 40 men in the room, including, you know, the 12-year-old boys on up. And he addressed them all and said, hello, thanks for coming. This is Nicole. Nicole, tell them what you told me.
It went straight to the point.
That's right.
You know, it's interesting you're talking about going back to the colony and texting everybody on the way there. This image that some people may have of Hutterite colonies and other kind of spiritually directed entities as being somehow technically, you know, they just kind of wave their hands and hope that everything will work out. These folks are highly sophisticated, and they have adopted a vast range of the things that we consider sort of the leading edge, the cutting edge of social development.
Their tractors are all, they have GPS in all their tractors. They're using drones to monitor their fields, as well as doing the field walks. But they're early adopters.
I can't help but thinking that you might be listening to country and Western music in their GPS-guided tractors.
I don't think that they listen to music, honestly. I think that's one of the things that they don't do.
We'll have to have a conversation with Hutterites. Anyway, so here's this meeting. This large, taciturn gentleman who hardly ever smiles has introduced Nicole in a very direct way. What happened then?
So she told them that some of their fields were low in manganese and boron and calcium, and that they were the big thing was that they were over applying nitrogen. And her recommendation was that they should reduce their nitrogen application by 70%.
My goodness, that's a lot.
That is a lot. And that they needed to do some other things.
Was the nitrogen coming from manure? Was this manure nitrogen?
They were actually, they didn't have enough manure, so they were buying chemical fertilizer.
My Lord.
Yeah, so that's a significant saving. And it's not just the saving of the nitrogen itself, but it's also the application. And the other thing that she said is that they needed to get some vermiculture going so that they would have worm castings and some other various things that are manganese and boron in particular, to get those things on. Mm. So what happened was they maintained their yields for that crop season. This is 2016, so 5 years ago. They maintained their yields despite reducing their nitrogen fertilizer by 70%. Mm. They maintained their yields, they reduced their costs. At the end of the year, they were $1 million to the good.
That is a lot of money, Andrea.
That makes an impact.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Yes. And it was from cost savings and the fact that their yields were as high. So the second year, they followed her advice again, reduced their nitrogen by, so that was 2016 she went in. 2017, they reduced their nitrogen again. 2018, they were not applying any chemical fertilizer. Their yields had gone up. The quality had gone up. Their costs had gone down, the costs of applying things. And within 3 years, their farming financials had changed to the good by $10 million.
This is, I'm sure listeners hearing these descriptions will be scratching their heads, and yet this is real. This is not a promotional video for
not
anything.
At all.
This is an actual description of what a group of focused people did when they changed the way they related to the land, and their ability to do that in a coordinated way was perhaps enhanced by the fact that it is a Hutterite community and they work together and they know how to collaborate. So there's a kind of a hidden message there about how collaboration and working together and all coming along in
and
the
focus.
Same path. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the really interesting thing for me was when I went to the Western Canadian Soil Health and Grazing Conference in Edmonton in 2019, at the end of those 3 years, how many other Hutterite colonies were in attendance at that conference? Because the Hutterite colonies are linked, and so this story has gone through like wildfire.
So,
and there were colonies from Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba. There were farmers from BC, farmers and ranchers from BC. And it was really quite astonishing how much enthusiasm there was with the 1,500 or 2,000 operations that were in attendance at that conference.
So what you're saying is
this kind of move.
So what you're saying is that this approach is also not only spreading like wildfire through the Hutterite community, but is starting to spread into the average farmer.
Absolutely.
Operation.
Absolutely.
Could you give a rough idea of what percentage of these 15,000 operators might be embracing this new approach? I mean, is it 3%, but it was none before? Is it 5%, 25%, roughly?
So of the farmers that I met at that conference, and I, you know, made sure that I was talking to as many people as possible, there were a number that I met from BC. Since coming back, of course, I didn't meet everyone. Since coming back, there were some meetings here in the Shuswap just a couple of months after that where people who were at that conference came to this meeting on what can we do in this area here on regenerative agriculture. And the two or three other people who had gone to that conference had talked to enough people that there were between 30 and 40, mostly dairy farmers, at that meeting. And in the North Okanagan Shuswap, I think at this point we've got 80 dairy farms. It's down from 20 years ago when it was 120. So half of the dairy farms in this region were at those meetings. Hmm. I'm sure that when COVID is over and we can meet in person again, that all of the dairy farmers, I'm sure that all the dairy farmers have been meeting and talking about this in their own meetings.
When you see this process unfolding, Andrea, and having been involved in the field of agriculture for decades, what's it like for you to watch this transformational process going on? And by the way, for listeners, Andrea has a big smile on her face.
You know, Warren, I spent probably 10 or 12 years being so like low-level depressed about the future of the world. And this has given me enormous hope. I am so excited and so delighted that we can make change when we educate ourselves and when You know, we're selfish and lazy as a species. We will do the least we possibly can until the crunch. And the crunch is upon us.
Yes.
And now we will just throw everything we have, just like Great Britain in the Second World War, just like all the world governments through COVID. We will bring everything, all our resources together. And the big thing is changing our minds. I'm watching a farming community which is very resistant to change. And that has given me such enthusiasm, I'm not depressed. I'm excited. I'm believing that we can make a difference.
At this point, I almost think we should stop the show right now and let listeners go away and just listen to what you've just said and the palpable enthusiasm that you've radiated into the airwaves with what you've just said. And I think it's particularly relevant because you do know a lot about agriculture. There are some people who orate and enthuse about things and they know very little about it, but they think it's a good idea. You're speaking from a position where you've been immersed in the field for four decades and more, and that I think gives added weight to your enthusiasm. It's just not just pie in the sky. It's pie in the eye is another thought, isn't it? In certain people who don't necessarily embrace these new ideas, a little pie in the eye might help them along. But this notion that word of mouth and evidence is now transmitted around the world. And what you're saying about Zoom and about COVID and the changes introduced also plays into that. You could have somebody in China hearing this news or somebody in China knowing this and radiating it back to other sources, other listeners and observers, and having an impact that's kind of like a nuclear reaction. Once it starts, it suddenly takes off and it becomes almost universal. So with these changes, obviously the world observing these changes is also changed by their observations. How is the broad agricultural community in the shoe swap being influenced by these new trends?
The broad agricultural community, well, as I have said, I believe in an earlier broadcast, 80% of the arable agricultural land is under forage crops that are for the dairy industry. And so the broad agricultural community is actually the dairy industry, and everybody else is small potatoes. And so those people who are not running a livestock operation are mixed farms or horticultural operations. And if people have been paying attention to land use and food production, they know that permaculture is something that a number of people have been touting for a couple of decades. And there are a number of practitioners of permaculture who have been giving permaculture design courses, weekend courses, evening courses for a number of years now. And so people are understanding on a small scale that if you don't till the soil, if you go with zero till kinds of activities, that you can have better productivity. You've got better soil aggregation, your soil's holding moisture, and so some of these things are happening. One of the studies that I did a few years ago, I think about 4 years ago, the Ministry of Agriculture knows that there are some issues in the dairy industry with nutrient excess. And I finished this study. I had been talking to people in Germany, in Holland, in the UK, all down the Eastern Seaboard. Ontario Ministry of Agriculture and Food had brought some pieces of equipment from Europe and was field testing them, and the farmers in Ontario were using them. And I was suggesting that the Ministry of Agriculture do the same thing. I wasn't getting a lot of uptake on that. I finished the study, sent it off, and within a week, one of those pieces of equipment, that's about a $150,000 piece of equipment that you can only buy in Europe, is on the back of a tractor going past me on the road in the opposite direction. And I'd been searching for these pieces of equipment, hadn't found a single one in Western Canada. There were a couple in Washington State. And here's somebody within 5 miles of my house. And it's a Dutch farmer. Their family came over in the early 1980s, and he is a grain farmer. And because of the Dutch connection, very much watches what's happening in equipment innovation in Europe. And there are a number of local farmers in whatever area within this. There are lots of German and Dutch, Austrian, Swiss producers here. And they have that connection to Europe. So the innovation that's happening in agriculture in Europe gets brought over here much more quickly than they're the leaders for our industry.
So let's use a couple of terms here that we've discussed before and also today: regenerative agriculture and permaculture, which started up in Australia decades ago and now has become basically global. They're sort of the same thing, but they come from different sources or different origins. Maybe you could just describe what the two terms mean and how they interact and how they differ somewhat.
Oh, that's a very interesting one. So they are both aimed at biodiversity. Regenerative agriculture is more focused on using a whole farm system, and working with the resources that you have to make sure that to mirror the biological diversity below ground with biological diversity above ground, and really looking at either zero till or low till, no till kinds of systems to improve that. The permaculture system is more of a perennial system where you integrate woodlands and cropping systems in a this is a really interesting one for me to try and describe. It's a much more integrated sort of more on an agroforestry woodland food forest concept where you are working not just with the soil but with the above ground plant and animal systems. So, for instance, in an agroforestry system, you're growing a perennial
perennial wood crop, but you're also perhaps, while that wood crop is young, while your trees are young, you might put in strawberries or raspberries or a mix of berry crops and annual crops, and maybe a livestock component layers work well with something like that. So you're looking at a whole continuum of more of the perennial, like the long-lived perennial crops that are growing on a 200-year cycle, with everything in between staged. Whereas regenerative agriculture is much more, the way that it's practiced, that I've seen, is much more an integration between the field crops and the livestock component, so that those forage crops are leaving you with soils that have got higher moisture retention and higher carbon sequestration, that the soils are actually going from pale colored soils to dark colored soils because they're holding carbon, and you can see that build up over a relatively short period of time.
Just to put a little diversion from what we're talking about, there's another process, another material that's been used for a number of years called biochar. And biochar was discovered primarily in some indigenous settings where it was widely used as a soil enhancement, a way of somewhere between charcoal and wood, you have biochar, which has some components in it not present in either, and then you added to the soil. I know it's a bit of a niche subject, but have you heard much about biochar being introduced anywhere in this part of the world, or people talking about it at all?
There certainly are people that believe in its properties. The challenge that I see with it is that it depends on what your soil is like. So here in this area of the world, we've got very mineral soils. Biochar is an excellent amendment in areas of the world where the soils are much older, so tropical soils, for instance, where it works very, very well. And that, yes, the South American cultures that used it for thousands of years and had very productive soils, without that component, their soils really don't work very well because they are ancient soils and the mineralization has been drawn out of them. We've got very young soils and very, very mineral rich soils. So I haven't seen it work as well as a soil building component, but I know that people who are using it for a variety of things in agricultural systems and seeing good results. So again, you need to know a lot about your soils.
Well, it also seems, from what you're saying, like it would have primary utility in parts of the world where, as you say, soils are old and depleted and they need to be regenerated in a very sort of intimate way with that specific amendment, rather than up here where we, as I say, most of the energy is in the soil, whereas in tropical settings, it's mostly in the vegetation and the biomass.
Yes.
There's some things that have emerged, and we can kind of summarize briefly because we're coming near the end of the show. Communication has changed. Collaboration is changing, and there's a multi-leveled approach taking place to transformation in the agricultural sector. Some of it is because of the pandemic, which has placed people back in their Zoom studios. And it's also because the communication channels are now open globally. And that's resulted in the fact that it's no longer just one sector or one level within a sector, the government, the bureaucracy, the field operators, the consumers. Everybody's kind of coming together in this kind of process. Maybe just comment as we come to the end. If that seems like an appropriate summation of what you see going on.
I think one of the things that I've seen that has given me such optimism is that the industry itself, people within the industry, we have not had extension services provided by the government in any tangible way for so long. And producers, because there is a generational shift that's happening right now with the aging of our population and new producers, a new generation coming in, they are hungry for information. And the technology has allowed sharing. And because we don't have this resilience, this reliance on the government to provide the research and extension, because it's so long since they've been able to, that the industry is pulling itself along by its own bootstraps and forging those alliances between communities. It's not dissimilar, actually, to the Quebec system, where in the region, producers will have regular meetings, regular conversations about what's going on across the industries within a community. And then the various communities, so for instance, the dairy farmers from across Quebec will all meet. And we're doing that kind of thing here under the industry by being at different conferences, by attending different webinars and looking to see who else is there and then having conversations with them, reaching out. So I have a number of people that will reach out to me every time I attend one of these things. Somebody else will say, what did you think of, you know, speaker A, B, or C? And did you, you know, did he go along with what you're learning on your farm? And there'll be a number. We will chat and text with each other while we're attending these things. And various people get caught up in those communication circles. And so that's a very different system than was the case, you know, 20 years ago. And so we've got this new generation with new communication technologies. And I think that it is spreading. There are so many people who are telling the story because it's such a hopeful, optimistic story that we can turn this around, that we can have better economic viability. Most of the farmers in Canada live below the poverty line. Here is a way to reduce your inputs, which is good for the planet, and it's good for your bank account too.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary how quickly people talk about how quickly bad news moves around. But I think it's fair to say that good news, especially when it's genuinely good news, when it's good news at different levels, as you say, economically, ecologically, socially, in every way, it's good news. Andrea, thank you so much for sharing some really good news with us today and for being once again a delightful interviewee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure, Warren. This was fun.